woods, looking for milkweed. I wish I'd listened more carefully. I wish I could remember more the fact that it has pinkish-purple flowers. And even though milkweed grows wild on parcels of land like this and flowers in the spring, I don't see its white-beaded, downy leaves anywhere. When Mama first realized that something was seriously wrong with her body, that it had betrayed her and turned cancerous, she began by treating it herself with herbs. I'd come home on those spring mornings to find her bed empty. She'd be out in the woods, picking and slowly dragging bushels of young pokeweed shoots behind her. Every time, she said, "I'm telling you, it's going to cure it." I'd take the bundles from her, put my arm around her waist and help her up the steps and into the house, where I'd set her in a chair in the kitchen. I was always buzzing from the night before, so while I chopped and cleaned and boiled and made pitcher after pitcher of tea for her to drink, the high would trill through my veins like a discordant song. But it didn't cure it. Her body broke down over the years until she took to her bed, permanently, and I forgot so much of what she taught me. I let her ideas drain from me so that the truth could pool instead. Sometimes the world don't give you what you need, no matter how hard you look. Sometimes it withholds. If the world were a right place, a place for the living, a place where men like Michael didn't end up in jail, I'd be able to find wild strawberries. That's what Mama would look for if she couldn't find milkweed. I could borrow the leaves at Michael's lawyer's house, where we're staying before we go pick Michael up in the morning. Put a little sugar in it, a little food coloring like Mama used to do whenever I had an upset stomach as a child, and tell her it's juice. But the world ain't that place. Ain't no wild strawberries at the side of the road. It ain't boggy enough up here. But this world might be a place that gives a little luck to the small. Sometimes shows a little mercy, because after I walk a while down the side of the road out of sight of the gas station, after I leave Misty gesturing out the window with her arm yelling, "Fucking come on!" I find wild blackberries. Mama always told me they could be used for upset stomach, but only for adults. But if there was nothing else, she said I could make a tea and give it to kids. Not a lot, I remember her saying. From the leaves. Or was it from the vine? Or the roots? The heat beats down so hard I can't remember. I miss the late spring chill. This is the kind of world it is. The kind of world that gives you a blackberry plant, a doughy memory and a child that can't keep nothing down. I kneel by the side of the road, grab the thorny stems as close to the earth as I can get them, and pull, and the vine pricks my hand, tears at the skin, draws blood in tiny points that smear. My palms burn. This the kind of world, Mama told me when I got my period when I was 12, that makes fools of the living and saints of them once they dead, and devils them throughout. Even though the words were harsh, I saw hope in her face when she said them. She thought that if she taught me as much herbal healing as she could, if she gave me a map to the world as she knew it, a world plotted orderly by divine order, spirit, and everything, I could navigate it. But I resented her when I was young, resented her for the lessons and the misplaced hope. And later, for still believing in good in a world that cursed her with cancer, that twisted her limp as an old dry rag and left her to disintegrate. I kneel and lean back on my haunches. The day pulses like a flush vein. Wipe my eyes, smear dirt across my face, and make myself blind.
Chapter 5, JoJo. Kayla need to eat. I could tell by the way she keep crying, the way she keep hunching over and then knocking her head back and arching against her seat once we get back on the road, and screaming. I can tell there's something wrong with her stomach. It won't stop hurting her. She need to put something in it. So I take her out and let her sit on my lap, thinking it might make her feel better, but it don't. She scream a little softer, her cries a little less high-pitched and sharp. The pain's knife-edged dulls. But she still knocks her head against my chest, and her skull feels thin against my bones, against the stone where my ribs meet. Her skull easy to break as a ceramic bowl. Leonie done laid her plants on the armrest between her and Misty. And minute by minute, mile by mile, those blackberry leaves get more and more wilted. The roots get stringier and stringier, sling their dirt loose in clumps. Kayla growls and cries. I don't want Leonie giving her that. I know that's what she thinks she need to do, but she ain't ma'am. She ain't pop. She ain't never healed nothing or grown nothing in her life, and she don't know. She bought me a betta fish when I was 6, after I kept telling her the same story every day about the tanks we had in my class at school. The betta fish, red and purple and blue and green, swimming lazily in the tanks, flashing brilliant then dull. She came home with one on Sunday, after she'd been out all weekend. I had seen her since Friday, since she told ma'am she was going to the store to buy some milk and some sugar and didn't come back. When she came back, her skin was dry and flaking at the corners of her mouth, her hair stuck out in the bushy halo, and she smelled like wet hay. The fish was green, the color of pine needles, and he had stripes down his tail the color of red mud. I called him Bubby Bubbles, since he blew bubbles all day, and when I leaned over his tank, I could hear him crunching on the fish food Leonie had brought him in a sample-sized bag. I imagine even that one day, I could lean over his bowl and instead of crunching, little words would pop out of bubbles that fizz up to the surface. Big face, light, and love. But when the sample size of fish food ran out, and I asked Leonie to buy some more, she forgot, again and again. Until one day she said, give him some old bread. I figured he couldn't crunch like he needed on some old bread, so I kept bugging her about it. And Bubby got skinnier and skinnier, his bubbles smaller and smaller, until I walked into the kitchen one day, and he was floating on top of the water, his eyes white, a slimy scrim-like fat, no voice in his bubbles. Leonie killed things. Outside the car, the trees thin and change, the trunks shorten and they get fuller and green, the leaves not sharp dark pine, but so full, hazy almost. They stand in thin lines between fields, fields of muddy green, bristling with low plants. The sky darkens. The forests and fields around us turn black. I put my mouth to Kayla's ear and tell her a story. You see them trees over there? She groans. If you look at the ground under them trees, there's a hole. She moans. Rabbits live in them holes. One of them is a little rabbit, the littlest rabbit. She got brown fur and little white teeth like gum. She's quiet for a second. Her name Kayla like you. You know what she do? Kayla shrugs and sinks back into me. She the best at digging holes. She digged them the deepest and the fastest. One day it was dark and a big storm come, and the rabbit family's hole started filling up with water. So Kayla started digging, and digging and digging. You know what she did? Kayla's breath hitches, and then she turns to face me and puts her mouth in my shirt and sucks in more air. I rub her back in circles, rub her like I could rub away the cramping, the hurt, whatever's making her sick. She dug and dug, the tunnel got longer and longer, the water wasn't even coming in where Kayla was digging, but she kept on until she popped up out the ground, and you know what? Kayla digs her fingernails into my arm, then raises up a little to look out the window and points out the dark fields at the thin line of trees with the rabbit hole underneath it. Getting dark, she says, and then she leans back into me and slumps. Uh-huh. Little rabbits are the gray barn and the fat pig and the red horse and Mam and Pop. She dug all the way to our house, Kayla, and when she saw Mam and Pop, she loved them, and she decided to stay. So when we get home, she's gonna be waiting for us. You wanna see her? I ask, but Kayla is asleep. She twitches, and for a blink I imagine I know what she's dreaming, but then I stop. She smells sharp like sweat and throw up. But her hair smells like coconuts from the oil Mam used to put in it, the one I use now when I pull her hair into little ponytails. two little cotton balls on the sides of her head. I block out the image of her in the wet earth, the size of a rabbit digging a hole. I don't want to know that dream. When we pull off the highway and onto the back road, the sky is dark blue, turning his back to us, pulling a black sheet over his shoulder. The world shrinks to the headlights coming from the car, twin horns leading through the darkness, the car an old animal limping to another clearing in the woods. Pop always told me you can trust an animal to do exactly what it's born to do, to root in mud or canter through a field of fly. That no matter how domesticated an animal is, Pop say the wild nature in it will come through. Kayla is her most animal self, a worm-ridden cat in my arms. When we finally pull into a yard and the trees open up, this place is different. It's not like the huddle of houses in Forest County. There is only one house here, and it's wide. There are windows along the front, and warm yellow light shines through all of them. Leonie stops the car. Misty gets out and waves at us to follow. I walk to the porch with Kayla asleep in my arms, snoring, breathing out of her mouth. And I see up close the paint is peeling in thin strips with marker-thin lines of brown-gray showing through. The windows look a little cloudy, like the water my fish died in. The wisteria planted on each side of the front steps has rooted thick into the earth, grown as big around us, a man's muscly arm, and has twisted and twined up the railings to weave thick as a curtain along the front of the porch. Here, the animal coming out. Missy knocks on the door. "Come in," a man voice sings, and there is music behind it. He's a big man. We find him in the kitchen boiling noodles for spaghetti. My mouth turns to water. I have never been so hungry. "Smell good, doesn't it?" he says as he walks towards us. He bounces, seems to walk on his tiptoes. He has a white long-sleeve shirt on, except it's rolled up to his elbows. The shirt is like his porch, the thread coming loose at the neck, something that looks like green paint splattered across the front. His kitchen is green. I ain't never seen a green kitchen. That's when I smell the sauce. It pops in his pot on the stove and streaks his arm as he stirs it. He licks it off. The noodles he put in the water slowly sink, disappear down the edges of the pot as their bottoms turn soft. I frown when he licks his furry arm. His hair is pulled back on his head and he has it in a little ponytail that sticks out, short as Kayla's. "Figured y'all would be hungry," he says. He's the whitest white man I've ever seen. "You figured right." Misty hugs the man as she says this, turns her face so that she speaks it into his paint-splattered shirt. "Took us longer to make it here because this little one got sick." "Ah, yes, the little girl," he said. Leonie looks like she wants to shush him, but she doesn't. "She's..." He pauses. "Sticky." Now Leonie looks like she wants to punch him. "Her mulish look," Pop says. "Is the young man sick too?" I already like him better, even though when he looks at me I see something like sadness in his face and I don't know why. "No," Leonie says. She crosses her arms when she says it. "We're not hungry." "Nonsense," the man says. "Leonie," Misty says, and looks at Leonie. I know it's the kind of look that says something else without saying it, but I can't read Leonie's eyebrows, her lips, the way she nods her head forward, her long bangs fall in her eyes. Whatever Misty says, Leonie understands and nods back. "We'll eat," Leonie clears her throat. "I was wondering if I could use your stove. I got something I need to cook." "Of course, my dear, of course." Up close, the man smells like he ain't took a bath in a few days, but it's not a musty smell. It smells sweet and wrong at the same time, like sweet liquor that done sat out in the heat and started turning to vinegar. "Excuse the French, Al, but I'm fucking starving," Misty smiles. When I sit in the living room, Kayla stays asleep, breathing hot into my shirt with little puffs. The room has high ceilings and bookshelves on every wall. There is no TV. There's a radio in the kitchen where Misty is sitting at a counter stool, drinking a glass of wine Al has poured for her in a mason jar. The music, all violins and cellos, swells in the room, then recedes, like the water out in the gulf before a big storm. When Leonie comes in from the car, holding her weeds in one hand, she trips on the rug covering the wooden floor, red and orange and white and frayed. and a bag falls from under her shirt, hits the carpet, and what was inside the crinkled brown paper slides out. It is clear, a whole pack of broken glass, and I've seen this before. I know what this is. The man is laughing at something Misty says, and Leonie will not look at me as she picks it up, scoops it back in the bag, and slumps over the counter before sliding it to Misty, who passes the bag to Al. He picks it up, tosses it into the air, and then makes it disappear like a magician. Al is Michael's lawyer. "Boys around his age," he says, pushing his sleeves up and his arm frowning after pointing at me, "and they thought he was selling weed in school." Misty swigs her drink. "And do you know what they did to him?" She shrugs. "Brought up to the principal's office with two other boys his age, friends. Made them drop their pants and strip so they could search them." Misty shakes her head swinging around her face. "That's a damn shame," she says. "It's illegal, is what it is. It's pro bono, and the school will probably get off with some sort of censure from the courts. But I couldn't not take it," he says, shrugging and drinking. Long moral arc of the universe and all. Misty nods like she knows what he's talking about. She pulled out her ponytail to let her hair hang, and every time she nods or shakes her head, she does it so violently, her hair swings, as languid and pretty as Spanish moss across her back. She's pulled her shirt down at the collar, let it sag, so her shoulder is a gleaming globe in the living room light. Al has all the lamps lit. The more she drinks, the more her hair swings. "You do what you can." Al smiles, touches her shoulder, and lifts his cup of wine. "How do you like it? It's good, right? I told you it was a good year." "So what you doing about my man?" Misty leans toward him and raises her eyebrows and smiles. "Okay, okay," Al says, leaning back away from her to laugh before coming toward her, talking with his hands, telling her about whatever he's doing to help free Bishop. Leonie is sitting on the sofa next to me, sippy cup in hand. It took her around 30 minutes to cut the blackberry plant, boil the roots and the leaves. She boiled the root in one pot and the leaves in the other, while I hunched over my plate shoving spaghetti into my mouth, hardly chewing. She let it cool. She stood at the counter squinting and talking to herself with her arms crossed, and then she poured half from one pot and half from the other pot into Kayla's cup. It was gray. I shoved the last of the food in my mouth, went to rinse my plate off and put it into the dishwasher, which smelled sour, and watched while she asked Al if he had any food coloring and sugar. He did. She dumped a few spoons of sugar and drops of food coloring into the cup and shook it until it looked like muddy Kool-Aid. Now she's sitting next to Kayla, who we left sprawled asleep on the couch, and she's trying to nuzzle her awake. Every time she asks Kayla to wake up, kisses her ear and neck, Kayla reaches up and puts her arm around Leonie's neck and pulls like she wants her to lay down, to go to sleep with her, like she doesn't want to be woken. It scares me. "Come on, Michaela," Leonie says, and she tugs Kayla upright. Kayla opens her eyes and slumps like Leonie did in the kitchen when she passed that package across, whining and trying to lie back down. "You thirsty?" Leonie whispers, putting the cup in front of Kayla. "Here, drink," she says. "No," Kayla says and slaps the cup away. It flies out of Leonie's hand and rolls across the floor. "She don't want it," I say. "Don't matter what she want," Leonie say, rolling her eyes at me. "She need it." I want to tell her, "You don't know what you're doing. And then you ain't ma'am." But I don't. The worry bubbling up in me like water boiling over the lip of a pot. But the words sticking in my throat. She might hit me. I did a lot of talking when I was younger. When I was 8 and 9 in public. And then one day she slapped me across the face. And after that, every time I opened my mouth to talk against her, she did that. Hit me so hard her slap started feeling like punches. Made me twist to the side. My hand on my face. Made me sit down once in the middle of the aisle in Walmart, so I stopped. But she doesn't know how to make medicine out of plants, and I worry for Kayla. 2 years ago, when I was so sick with the stomach bug that I could hardly get up off the sofa and make it to the bathroom, Mam told Leona to go to gather some plant in the woods and make tea out of the roots. She did it. And because Mam told her to do it, I trusted her, and I drank it, even though it tasted like rubber. Leonie must have picked the wrong plant or prepared it wrong because whatever she gave me made me even sicker. She poured the gritty, bitter mess by the back steps, and a few days afterward, when I had worked whatever she gave me and the bug out of my system, I found a stray cat dead, carbuncular and rotting by the steps. It had drunk whatever she poured into a pool on the ground. Leonie's picked up the cup, holding it to Kayla's lips. "You thirsty, right?" she says, and it's an answer, not a question. Kayla coughs and grabs at the cup. My underarms spike in sweat, and I want to grab that sippy cup and throw it like she did, batter it across the room, and snatch it out of the loose circle of Leonie's arm. But I don't. And then she's sucking at the spout and turning up her cup and drinking, and I feel like I lost a game I didn't know I was playing. "She just need to sleep it off," Misty says. "Probably car sick, that's all." Kayla is thirsty. She's drunk half of it, and she's pulling hard on the spout, her lips puckered like it's a bottle. When she's done, she lets the cup clatter to the floor, and she crawls across the sofa into my lap, grabbing my hand and saying, "Down," which means up. She wants me to tell her a story. I lean in. "I have a better vintage in the kitchen," Al says, looking at Leonie. "Maybe we could sample it this evening?" "Sounds good to me," Missy says. "I don't know," Leonie says. She's looking at Kayla in my lap, Kayla who is beginning to fuss because I haven't begun the story yet. She's beginning to squirm and cry again like she did in the car before she threw up. She ain't feeling good. "I'm telling you, it's probably car sickness. Let her sleep it off," Misty says. "She'll be fine." And then she looks at Leonie like she's saying two things at once, one with her mouth and the other with her eyes. "You've been driving all day. Might be so nice to unwind and take a break." I can't read her yet. Leonie reaches out and smooths Kayla's hair down, but it springs back up. Kayla curves away from her. "You're probably right," Leonie says. "You know how many times I threw up with my head out the window when I was a kid? I lost count. She'll be fine," Misty says. It looks like Misty said the right thing this time, because Leonie sits back then. There's a wall between us. "Michael got motion sickness bad. He can't even ride in the back seat without feeling like throwing up." It makes sense to Leonie then. Must have got it from him. "See?" Misty nods. Al nods. They all nod and rise and head off to the kitchen. I take Kayla into the bedroom Al pointed us to earlier, with two twin beds. I take off Kayla's shirt, which smells like acid, and wet and soap a rag from the bathroom next to the bedroom, and then wipe her off. She's hot. Even her little feet. So hot. I take off everything but her drawers and lay down with her in one of the twin beds, and she puts her little arm over my shoulder and pulls me to her, like she does every morning when we wake up together. "Dodo," she says. I lay there until the music goes quiet in the kitchen, and I hear her moving out to the back porch. No glasses clink, no wine. I figured I'd open up that pack Leonie brought. I lay there until I can't no more, and then I carry Kayla into the bathroom and stick my finger down her throat and make her throw up. She fights me, hitting at my arms, crying against my hand, sobbing but not making no words, but I do it three times, make her vomit over my hand, hide as her little body three times, all of it red, smelling sweet, until I'm crying and she's shrieking. I turn off the light and go back into the room and wipe her with my shirt and lay in the bed with her, scared that Leonie's gonna walk in and find all that red throw up in the bathroom. Find out I made Kayla throw up Leonie's potion. But nobody comes. Kayla sniffs and dozes off, hiccuping in her sleep, and then I clean all of it up with soap and water until the bathroom is as white as it was before. All the while, my heart is beating so hard I can hear it in my ears because I knew what Kayla was saying. I knew. "I love you, Jojo. Why you make me, Jojo? Jojo, brother, brother." I heard her. I try to sleep, but for hours I can't. All I can do is lay there and listen to Kayla breathe. Outside, somewhere far away off in the dark reach of the woods, a dog barks. It's a hacking sound, full of anger and sharp teeth. At the heart of it all, fear. When I was younger, I wanted a puppy. I asked Pop for one, and he said ever since his time in Parchment, he couldn't keep a dog. He said he tried when he got let out, but every one of the dogs he got, mutts and hounds, died within the first year of him getting it. When he was in Parchment, Pop said, once he started working with the hounds the prison used to track escapees, all he could smell when he was eating or walking or falling asleep was dog shit. All he could hear was the dogs yipping and howling and baying, raring to tear. Pop said he tried to get Richie on with the dogs so he could get him out the fields, but it didn't work. I closed my eyes and imagined Pop sitting on the high back chair in the corner of the room. Pop, with his straight back and his hands like tree roots, telling me more stories, speaking me to sleep. Was one of them days when the sun bear down on you so hard feel like it's twisting you inside out, and all you do is burn. One of them heavy days, down here, is different. We got that wind coming off the water all the time, and that eases. But up there, they ain't got that. Just the fields stretching on, the trees too short with not enough leaves, no good shade nowhere, and everything bending low. Under the weight of that sun, men, women, mules, everything low under God. Was a day like that, the boy broke his hoe. I don't think he meant to do it. He wasn't nothing but a scrawny thing, littler than you. I already told you that, so he must have hit a rock or leant on it the wrong way, and that's what did it. Kenny had me running the dogs around the fields, working their sense of smell. I was circling Richie's field when I saw him walking with the two pieces in his hand, just ragging the handle in the dirt, little trail following him to the wood line. The driver, the man who set the pace for the day's work, something like an overseer, saw Richie. He sat up on his mule and watched the boy's back, and he looked more and more mad, like a snake drawing down and bunching up before he strike. I edged round the field until I could get close enough to Richie to hiss at him. Pick the handle up, boy, driver watching you, I said. He gonna beat me anyway, Richie said, but he picked the handle up. Who say? He say. The boy was jittery around the eyes, and even though he walked like he wasn't scared, the marks I saw in him when he came in Parchment told me that he knew what it was to be beat, whether it was his mama taking a belt buckle to him or some man. But I knew the boy wasn't ready for the whip. I knew he wasn't ready for Black Annie. I was right. Sun went down, and after supper, Sergeant tied him to some posts set at the edge of the camp. So hot, the sun still felt like it was up, and the boy laid there spread eagle on the ground in the dirt with his hands and legs tied to them posts. When that whip cracked in the air and came down on his back, he sounded like a puppy, yelped so loud. And that's what he kept doing over and over, just yelping for every one of them lashes, arching up off the ground, turning his head like he wanted to look at the sky, yelling like a drowning dog. When they untied him, his back was full of blood, them seven gashes laid open like filleted fish, and Sergeant told me to doctor on him. So I cleaned him up as he lay there throwing up with his face in the dirt. I ain't tell him to stop. Sergeant gave him a day to heal, but when they sent him back out in the field, them lashes on his back wasn't anywhere near healed, and they oozed and bled through his shirt. I can almost hear Pop in the dim room, which feels wet and close from all the hot water I ran to cover the sound of Kayla throwing up and to clean up after. He would shift and lean on his elbow, and his voice would rise out of the black like smoke. I wipe Kayla's hair away from her head, and she sweats. Whenever Pop talked about Richie getting whipped, he told me about Kenny, his boss in charge of the hunting hounds, who escaped the day after they flayed Richie's back. Kenny Wagner pulled his last escape that day. It was 1948. Walked right out of the front gates of Parchment with a machine gun he stole out of munitions. Warden was pissed. "I'll look a fool," he said. "Being the warden who let the damn man escape a third time, you want your job, you better catch him. Let the dogs," he told the sergeant. Sergeant looked at me, and I got the best of the pack. Axe and Red and Shank and Moon, all dogs Kenny name. and I let them loose and started tracking. But the dogs wouldn't track the man that fed them, the man that first touched them, the man that raised them. Kept walking slow and sat in circles through that country, slinking through those thin trees under that heavy sky, and I followed him, catching Kenny's tracks clear, but slowed down by the animals, so I had to go back at the end of the day, tell the sergeant the dogs wouldn't track their master. Him and two other sergeants and a gang of trusty shooters came out with me the next day, and it was the same. The hounds smelled that son of a bitch and thought he was their daddy. Couldn't savage him because when they slept, they dreamed of him, of his big red hands and his gray mouth, the stink that came off of him, all his sweating as dear to them as the scent from their mama's ears. I can tell Leonie ain't slept. She never came in the room last night, and this morning the music is still playing in the kitchen on Al's stereo, and all three of them look wrinkled, their clothes, their hair, their faces. Leonie's looking at the empty chair across from her, so she misses when I walk in the room. Kayla in my arms, her head on my shoulder. Normally she'd be asking for a dog. She likes hot dogs for breakfast. Or pointing outside, pulling my hand and saying, "Pop." But I woke to her touching my cheek right underneath my eye, looking very serious, not smiling. Her little hand is like a stick burned with fire and now throwing off heat, red and black. As I walk into the kitchen, Kayla breathes little huffs into my neck. I rub her back, and Leonie finally notices us. "They got oatmeal on the stove," Leonie says, all three of them drinking coffee, black and strong. "Did she throw up again?" "No," I say. Leonie looks toward the empty chair again. "She hot, though." Leonie nods, but she don't look at me. She look at the chair. Raise her eyebrows like somebody said something surprising. But Al and Misty are leaning into each other, murmuring things, whispering. Leonie ain't part of that conversation. I walk over to the pot and see the oatmeal crusted to the sides, burnt crispy on the edges, and jelly in the middle with cold. "Let's go get your man," says Misty, and they all stand. "But they haven't eaten," Al says. "They have to be hungry." "I'm not," I say, and my mouth tastes like old gum chewed almost to paste. I figure I'll eat some of the food I stole in the back seat on the way to the jail, ease the grinding suck of my stomach. Sneak some to Kayla if she'll let me. She burns in my arms, her neck against my neck, her little chin digging into my collarbone. Her legs dangle, lifeless as a carcass from a hook. "Let's go get your father," Leonie says. The jail is all low, concrete buildings and barbed wire fences crisscrossing through fields. The road stretches onward, out into the distance, and for a while, this road points us toward the men I was here. There's no other sign, nothing in those fields, no cows, no pigs, no chickens. There are crops coming in, baby plants, but they look small and stunted, as if they'll never grow. But a great flock of birds wheels through the sky, swooping and fluttering, moving gracefully as jellyfish. I watch them as Kayla mews in my ear, as we pass another sign, old and wooden, that says, "Welcome to Parchment, MS," and then, "Coke is it." But by the time we get out of the car in the parking lot, the birds have turned north, fluttered over the horizon. I hear the tail end of their chatter, all of those voices calling at once, and I wish I could feel the excitement, feel the joy of the rising, the swinging into the blue. The great flight, the return home, but all I feel is a solid ball of something in my gut, heavy as the head of a hammer. When we get to the jail proper, Leonie and Misty sign our names into a book, and then we're led into a room with cinder block walls painted yellow. Misty follows a guard through a door set at the opposite end of the room, where we sit at a table ringed by low benches like we could be taking a picnic while we wait on Michael. But there's no food, no blanket, and there's a white pockmark ceiling above us. No sky. Leonie rubs her arms, even though it's warm in here. Warmer even than outside. Feels like there's no air conditioning. She leans forward and rubs her eyes, smooths her hair back from her face, so for a second I see Pop, his flat forehead, his nose, his cheeks. That hammer in me twists, and then Leonie frowns, and her hair flops back over her forehead, and she's just Leonie. And Kayla whimpers again, and I want to go home. Choose, Kayla says. I look at Leonie, asking the question without saying nothing. Raised eyebrows, wide eyes, frown. Leonie shakes her head. She got to wait. She reaches out to Kayla, brushes her fingers along the back of her neck, but Kayla says no and burrows into my chest, her skull hard, her nose smushed into my shirt, trying to get away from Leonie's hand. I'm looking at Leonie's frown so hard that I don't even see Michael when he appears at the door. Two guards at his shoulders, who stop at the door and let him pass as it opens and clangs shut. And then all at once, he's standing in front of us. Michael's here. Baby, he says. I know he ain't talking to me or Kayla, but only Leonie. Because it's her who drops her arm and turns. Her who rises and walks stiff-kneed to him. Her that he hugs, his arms wrapped around her like a tangled sheet, tighter and tighter, until they seem one thing standing there. One person instead of two. He's bigger than I remember around the neck, and shoulders and arms, wider than he was when the police took him away. They're both shaking, speaking so low to each other. I can't hear them, whispering and shivering like a tree, juddering in the wind. It takes less time than I thought it would to check Michael out. Maybe he'd done all his paperwork beforehand. Misty is still in the other room talking to Bishop, but Michael says, I can't stay in here another minute. Let's go. Before I know it, we're walking back out into the weak spring light. Leonie and Michael have their arms around each other's waist. When we get back to the parking lot, they stop and begin kissing, wet, open mouth, their tongues sliding onto faces. He looks so different than he did when he left, but he's still the same Michael underneath, in the neck, in his hands, kneading Leonie's back the way Mam used to knead biscuits. Kayla points out to the fields, fields covered in a fog, and says, Jojo. I walk across the parking lot, closer to the fields with her. What you see, Kayla? I ask. All the birds, she says, and coughs. I look out at the fields, but I don't see birds. I squint, and for a second I see men bent at the waist, row after row of them, picking at the ground, looking like a great murder of crows landed and chattering and picking for bugs in the ground. One, shorter than the rest, stands and looks straight at me. See the bird? Kayla asks, and then she lays her head on my shoulder. I blink and the men are gone and it's just fog rolling, wisping over the fields that stretch out endlessly. And then I hear Pop telling me the last bit of the story he's willing to share about this place. After the Sergeant beat Richie, I told him, you got to keep that back clean. Got clean rags and put them on him, and then changed them with the supplies I stole from the dog stash. I bound them around Richie's chest with long strips. His skin was hot and runny. It's too much dirt, Richie said. His teeth was chattering. His words came out in stutters. It's everywhere, and feels, not just my back rib. It's in my mouth so I can't taste nothing, and in my ears so I can hardly hear, and in my nose, all in my nose and throat so I can hardly breathe. He breathed hard then, and ran out the shack where our group of trusty shooters bunked, and threw up in the dirt. And then I remembered again how young he was, how his big teeth were still breaking through his gums in some places. I dream about it. Dream I'm eating it with a big, long silver spoon. Dream that when I swallow, it go down the wrong hole to my lungs. Out there in the fields all day, my head hurt. I can't stop shaking. I touched his narrow back, pushed one of the cuts to see if pus would come out, trying to see if it was infected. If that's why he was sick with fever and chills. But it oozed a little clear and that's it. Something ain't right, I said to myself. But the boy was kneeling over his sick in the dirt, listening to the trusty shooters calling to each other on their patrol, shaking his head like I'd ask him a question, right to left, and then he said, I'm going home. See the birds? Kayla asks. Yeah, Kayla, I see, I tell her. All the birds go by, Kayla says. And then she leans forward and rubs my face with both hands. And for a second, I think she's going to tell me something amazing. Some secret. Something come from God himself.
My tummy, she says. Jojo, tummy hurts.
I rub her back. I ain't had a chance to give y'all a good hello, comes a voice, and I turn around and it's Michael. He's looking toward Kayla. Hello, he says. Kayla tenses up, grips me with her little legs, grabs both of my ears, and pulls.
No,
she says. I'm your papa, Michaela, Michael says. Kayla puts her face in my neck and starts to shake, and I feel it like little tremors through my gut. Michael lets his hands drop. I shrug, look past Michael's face, clean-shaved and pale, purple under his eyes, sunburned high on his forehead. He got Kayla's eyes. Leone's behind him, letting go of his hand to grab him around the waist. He reaches behind him to her and rubs. She got to get used to you, I say. I know, he says. When we got back to the car, Leone pulls out her little cooler and then hands out sandwiches that the lawyer must have made before me and Kayla woke up. Sandwiches on brown bread, thick with nuts, with slabs of smelly cheese and turkey slices thin as Kleenex layered in between. I ate mine so fast I have trouble breathing, and I start to hiccup around the food, big bites lodged in my throat. Leone frowns at me, but it's Michael who speaks. Take your time, son. He says it's so easy. Son. He got his arm on the back of the driver's seat, his hand wrapped around the back of Leone's neck, rubbing it, squeezing it soft. It's something like the way Mam would hold me by the neck when we went to the grocery store when I was little and both of us could walk up and down the grocery aisles. If I get too excited, like when we got to the checkout and saw all the candy she'd squeeze, not too hard, just enough to remind me that we was in the store, around a whole bunch of white people and that I needed to mind my manners. And then she was behind me, with me, loving me, here. If I wasn't hiccuping, I would cut my eyes at Michael, but the hiccuping is so bad I can't breathe. I think of Richie and wonder if this is how he felt in them dusty rows, how they must have stretched to the end of the earth before him, how this place must have gone on forever. But even as I'm gulping to swallow past the food to breathe easier, and another hiccup shakes through me, I know it must have been worse for the boy. A rain begins so light, it's like a gentle spray from a water bottle, and it turns the air white and everything looks hazy. I want another sandwich, but Michael is sitting where Misty sat, and he's eating his sandwich slow, tearing off his bites before putting them in his mouth. It's one of the things I heard Pop say about Michael when he moved in with us. Mike eat like he too good for the food, he told Mam. She shook her head and cracked another pecan, picking out the meat. We were sitting next to each other on the porch swing. I'm still so hungry I can imagine the taste of those pecans. How the dust around the nut tastes bitter, but the pecan is wet and sweet. Mam knew, but she ignored my thieving and let me eat. There's only one sandwich from the lawyer left in the bag, and Misty still hasn't eaten hers yet, so I swallow.
We got some water? I ask.
Leone passes me a bottle of water the lawyer must have given her. The plastic is thick and has mountains painted on the front. The water is warm, not cold, but I'm so thirsty and my throat is so clogged that I don't even care. The hiccups stop. Your sister finish hers? Leone asks. Kayla's fallen asleep in her car seat, which I had to move to the middle. Misty's back and she's sitting with me now that Michael's here. Kayla has half a sandwich in her hand, her fingers curled around it tight, her head tilted back and hot. Her nose is sweating, and her curls are getting stringy. I pull the sandwich from her grip and it comes, so I eat the rest of it, even though it's a little soggy where she was gumming it. Most of it, I say. She looked much better. Leone is lying. She don't look much better. Maybe a little, but not much. I knew the blackberry would work. Something wrong with her? She sick? Michael asks. His hand doesn't stop moving, and he turns around to look at us. I stopped chewing. In the gray foggy light, and in the close car, his eyes looked bright green, green as the trees pushing out new spring leaves. Leonie looks disappointed. He stopped touching her and leans across the seat toward him.
Just some kind of stomach virus, I think, or she was car sick. I gave her one of Mama's remedies. She better.
You sure, baby? Michael looks closely at Kayla, and I swallow the last of her sandwich. She still looks a little yellow to me.
Leonie gives a little half laugh and waves at Kayla. Of course she's yellow. She's our baby.
And then Leonie laughs, and even though it's a laugh, it doesn't sound like one. There's no happiness in it. Just dry air and hard red clay where grass won't grow. She turns around and ignores all of us and looks out the front windshield, gumming with bug splatter. So she doesn't even see when Kayla startles. Her eyes open wide and throw up brown and yellow and chunky, comes shooting out her mouth and all over the back of the front seat, all over her little legs and her little red and white Smurf shirt, and me because I'm pulling her up out of her seat and into my lap.
It's gonna be all right, Kayla. It's gonna be all right, I say.
I thought you gave her something for that, Misty says. Baby, I told you she didn't look good, Michael says.
God damn it, son of a bitch!
Leonie says, and a dark, skinny boy with a patchy afro and a long neck is standing on my side of the car, looking at Kayla and then looking at me. Kayla cries and whines.
The bird, she says.
The boy leans into the window and blurs at the edges. He says,
I'm going home.
Chapter 6. Richie. The boy is Rivers. I know it. I smelled him as soon as he entered the fields, as soon as the little red dented car swerved into the parking lot. The grass trilling and moaning all around. When I followed the scent to him, the dark, curly-haired boy in the back seat, even if he didn't carry the scent of leaves disintegrating to mud at the bottom of a river, the aroma of the bowl of the bayou, heavy with water and sediment, and the skeletons of small dead creatures, crab, fish, snakes, and shrimp, I would still know he's Rivers by the look of him. The sharp nose, the eyes dark as swamp bottom, the way his bones run straight and true as Rivers, indomitable as cypress. He is Rivers' child. When he returns to the car and I announce myself, I know he's Rivers again. I know it by the way he holds the little sick golden girl, as if he thinks he could curl around her, make his skeleton and flesh into a building to protect her from the adults, from the great reach of the sky, the vast expanse of the grass-ridden earth, shallow with graves. He protects as River protects. I want to tell him this. Boy, you can't. But I don't. Instead, I fold myself and sit on the floor of the car. In the beginning, I woke in a stand of young pine trees on a cloudy, half-lit day. I cannot remember how I came to be crouching in the pine needles, soft and sharp as boar's hair under my legs. There was no warmth or cold there. Walking was like swimming through tepid gray water. I paced in circles. I don't know why I stayed in that place. Why every time I got to the edge of the young stand, to the place where the pines reached taller, rounded and darkened, draped with a web of green thorny vines, I turned and walked back. In that day that never ended, I watched the tops of the trees toss, and I tried to remember how I got there. Who was I before this place, before this quiet haunt? But I couldn't. So when I saw a white snake, thick and long as my arm, slither out of the shadows beneath the trees, I knelt before it. You are here, it said. The needles dug into my knees. Do you want to leave? It asked. I shrugged. I can take you away, it said, but you have to want it. Where? I asked. The sound of my voice surprised me. Up and away, it said, and around. Why? There are things you need to see, it said. It raised its white head in the air and swayed, and slowly, like paint dissolving in water, its scales turned black, row by row, until it was the color of the space between the stars, Little fingers sprouted from its sides to grow to wings. Two perfect black scaly wings. Two clawed feet pierced its bottom to dig into the earth, and its tail shrunk to a fan. It was a bird, but not a bird. No feathers, all black scales. A scaly bird. A horned vulture. It bounced up to a light on the top of the youngest pine tree, where it bristled and cawed, the sound raw in that silent place. "Come," it said. "Rise." I stood. One of its scales dislodged and floated to the earth, wispy as a feather. "Pick it up. Hold it," it said, "and you can fly." I clenched the scale. It was the size of a penny. It burned my palm, and I rose up on my tiptoes, and suddenly I wasn't on the ground anymore. I flew. I followed the scaly bird up and up and out into the white water torrent of the sky. Flying was floating on that tumbling river. The bird at my shoulder now, a raucous smudge on the horizon then, sometimes atop my head like a crown. I spread my arms and legs and felt a laugh bubbling up in me, but it died in my throat. Because I remembered. I remembered before. I remembered being spread eagle in the dirt, surrounded by hunched, milling men and a teenage boy at my shoulder who stood tall under the long shadows. River. River, who stood as the men flayed my back. As I sobbed and vomited and turned the earth to mud, I could feel him there, knew that he would carry me after they let me loose from the earth. My bones felt pin thin, my lungs useless. The way he carried me to my cot, the way he bent over me, made something soft and fluttery as a jellyfish pulse in my chest. That was my heart. Him, my big brother. Him, my father. I dropped from my flight, the memory pulling me to the earth. The bird screamed, upset. I landed in a field of endless rows of cotton, saw men bent and scuttling along like hermit crabs, bending and picking. Saw other men walking in circles around them with guns. Saw buildings clustered at the edges of that field, other fields, unto the ends of the earth. The bird swooped down on the men's heads. They disappeared. This is where I was worked. This is where I was whipped. This is where River protected me. The bird dropped to the ground, dug its beak into the black earth, and I remembered my name. Richie. I remembered the place. Parchman Prison. And I remembered the man's name. River Red. And then I fell, dove into the dirt, and it parted like a wave. I burrowed in tight, needing to be held by the dark hand of the earth, to be blind to the men above, to memory. It came anyway. I was no more, and then I was again. The scale hot in my hand, I slept and woke and rose and picked my way through the prison fields, lurked in the barracks, hovered over the men's faces, tried to find River. He wasn't there. Men left. Men returned and left again. New men came. I burrowed and slept and woke in the milky light, my time measured by the passing of all those black faces and the turning of the earth, until the scaly bird returned and led me to the car, to the boy the same age as me sitting in the back of the car. Jojo. I want to tell the boy that I know the man who sired him, that I knew him before this boy. That I knew him when he was called River Red. The gunmen called him River because that was the name his mama and daddy gave him. And the men say he rolled with everything like a river, over the felled trees and stumps, through storms and sun. But the men added the red because that was his color, him the color of red clay on the riverbank. There's so much Jojo doesn't know. There's so many stories I could tell him. The story of me and Parchman, as River told it, is a moth-eaten shirt nibbled to threads. The shape is right, but the details have been erased. I could patch those holes, make that shirt hang new, except for the tails, the end. But I could tell the boy what I know about River and the dogs. When the warden and sergeant told River he was going to be in charge of the dogs after Kenny escaped, he took the news easy, like he didn't care if he did it or if he didn't. When they named River to keep the dogs, I heard the men talking, especially some of the old-timers. Said all the dog keepers were always older and white, long as they'd been there, long as they remembered. Even though some of those white men had been like Kenny, had escaped and then been sent back to Parchment after they'd been caught fleeing or had killed or raped or maimed, the sergeant still chose them to train the dogs. If they had any talent for it, they were given a job. Even if they were flight risks, even if they had done terrible things both in and out of Parchment, the leashes were theirs. Even though they were terrible, dangerous white men, the old-timers still took more offense when they knew Riv would be their hunter. They didn't like Riv taking care of the dogs. "It's different," they said, "for the black man to be trusted with a gun." Said, "That's unnatural, too. But that's Parchment." But it was something about a colored man running the dogs that was wrong. It always been bad blood between dogs and black people. They were bred adversaries, slaves running from the slobbering hounds and then the convict man dodging them. But River had a way with animals. The sergeant saw that. It didn't matter to him that Rib couldn't make the hounds hunt Kenny. The sergeant knew there wasn't another white inmate who could wrangle those dogs, so Rib was his best bet for training them, for keeping them keen. The dogs loved Riv. They turned floppy and silly when he came around. I saw it, because Riv asked them to transfer me out to the fields and over to him so I could assist him. He saw how sick I was after I got whipped. He thought if I were left to my despair, my slow knitting back, I would do something stupid. "You're smart," he said, "little and fast." He told the sergeant that I was wasted in the fields. But I didn't have River's way with the dogs. I think some part of me hated and feared them. And they knew it. The dogs didn't soften the silly puppies with me. Their tails stiffened, their backs straightened, and they stilled. When they saw Riv in the dark morning, they bounced and yapped. But when they saw me, they ossified to stone. River held out his hands to the dogs like he was a reverend and they were his church. They were quiet with listening, but he didn't say anything. Something about the way they froze together in the blue dawn was worshipful. When I held out my hand to them, like Riv told me, and waited for them to acclimate to my scent, to listen to me, they snapped and gurgled. Riv said, "Have patience, Richie. It's going to happen." I doubted. Even though the dogs hated me, and I still got up when the sun was a dim shine at the edge of the sky and spent all day hauling water and food and running after those mutts, I was still happier than I had been before, still lighter, almost, maybe okay. I know River hasn't told JoJo that, because I never told River that when I ran, it felt like the air was sweeping me along. I thought the wind might pick me up and hurl me through the air, buoy me up out of the shitty dog pens, the scarred fields, away from the gunmen and the trusty shooters and the sergeant up into the sky, that it would carry me away. When I was lying on my cot at night while River cleaned my wounds, those moments blinked around me like fireflies in the dark. I caught them in my hands and held them to me, a golden handful of light before swallowing them. I would tell JoJo this. That was no place for hope. It only got worse when Hogjaw returned to Parchment. They called him Hogjaw because he was big and pale as a 300-pound pig. His jaw was a hard square, his mouth a long, thin line. He had the jaw of a hog that would gore. He was a killer, everybody knew. He had escaped Parchment once, but then he committed another violent crime, shooting or stabbing someone, and he was sent back. That's what a white man had to do to return to Parchment. Even if he was free because he had escaped, a white man had to murder. Hogjaw did a lot of murdering, but when he came back, the warden put him over the dogs, over Riv. The warden said, "It ain't natural for a colored man to master dogs. A colored man doesn't know how to master because it ain't in him to master." He said, "The only thing a nigger knows how to do is slave." I wasn't light anymore. When I ran to fetch, I didn't feel like I was racing the wind. There were no more firefly moments to blink at me in the dark. Hogjaw smelled bad, sour like slop. The way he looked at me, there was something wrong about it.